to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. During his two terms in office, Obama carried out 586 strikes, largely with drones, in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, killing between 384 and 807 civilians. Trump lowered the bar even further for drone strikes. His administration reduced the requisite level of confidence that the target was present in a strike zone from nearby certainty to reasonable certainty. Under Trump, targets were not limited to high-value terrorists, but could include foot soldiers, whereas decisions about drone bombings had been made at the highest levels of government, with Obama having the final say about who would be targeted. Trump allowed commanders in the field to make targeting decisions. Trump gave increased authority to the Pentagon and CIA to conduct drone strikes. He weakened the targeting rules in large areas of Somalia and Yemen by designating them as areas of active hostilities, and Trump eliminated the government's commitment to report on civilian casualties. During his first 2 years in office, Trump launched 2,243 drone strikes compared to 1,878 in Obama's 8 years in office. In March, Biden secretly set temporary limits on drone strikes outside of recognized battlefields. He has ordered a comprehensive review of whether to keep Trump's relaxed rules in place or return to Obama-era rules or impose some middle ground. In any event, it is doubtful that Biden would comply any better than Obama did with the tighter rules. Although Biden is withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan, he is continuing to launch air strikes, including drone strikes there. We have been doing it where and when feasible, and we will keep doing it where and when feasible, an official involved in operational planning said, speaking on condition of anonymity. General Kenneth E. McKenzie, Jr., the top U.S. general in charge of Afghanistan, refused to say whether airstrikes would continue past the cutoff date of August 31st. The Air Force is requesting $10 billion to perpetuate the U.S. imperial footprint in South Asia and the West Asia region. On June 30, 113 organizations, including Veterans for Peace, wrote a letter to Biden to demand an end to the unlawful program of lethal strikes outside any recognized battlefield, including through the use of drones. The UN Charter requires that international disputes be settled peacefully. It allows a country to use military force only in self-defense after an armed attack or with the consent of the UN Security Council. Neither the US war in Iraq nor in Afghanistan complied with the Charter's mandates. Outside the context of active hostilities, the use of drones or other means for targeted killing is almost never likely to be legal. Agnes Callamard, the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, tweeted. She added that intentionally lethal or potentially lethal force can only be used where strictly necessary to protect against an imminent threat to life. Thus, Callamard said the United States would need to demonstrate that the target constituted an imminent threat to others. Targeted or political assassinations, also known as extrajudicial executions, violate international law. Willful killing is a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions and is punishable as a war crime under the U.S. War Crimes Act. Civilians must never be the target of military strikes, A targeted killing is only lawful if it is deemed necessary to protect life, and no other means, including capture or non-lethal incapitation, is available to protect life. Yet the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations have all prosecuted whistleblowers for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes. In addition to Hale, those courageous folks include Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and John Kiriakou, who revealed that CIA officials used waterboarding, which constitutes the war crime of torture.
Ties between the United States and Russia are far worse than strained. The two have been on a confrontational path for a very long time. Tensions have been deteriorating over the past years after a series of tit-for-tat actions that have left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such tit-for-tat actions, like consulate closures or expulsions of diplomats, have made it difficult to even conduct basic bilateral diplomacy. The lack of proper diplomatic contacts between the two rivals has increased the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a potential disaster. Recently, Russia's top diplomat warned that tensions between Washington and Moscow were getting close to a dangerous confrontation. The two sides say they want to prevent any such scenario. This week, diplomats from the U.S. and Russia sat down for talks on strategic stability. The talks in Geneva were arranged in June when U.S. President Joe Biden met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two major nuclear-armed states.
I think that what's happened in the last 20 years under Putin's basic leadership, I think for the last 20 years, has been a resurgence of Russian power, of Russian technology, of the place of Russia in the world. And as a major country, the United States doesn't like that.
Can the ongoing diplomatic effort help reduce tensions and pave the way for cooperation? The meeting on Wednesday was the first in a series of planned talks aimed at enhancing communication and reduce the possibility of missteps. The delegations were headed by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov. The U.S. side called the discussions professional and substantive. The Russians said they were satisfied with the conclusions and that America showed readiness for constructive dialogue. But despite the positive signs, controversial comments by the U.S. president drew condemnation from Moscow. In an address to national intelligence officers, Joe Biden accused Russia of trying to interfere in the 2022 U.S. midterm elections. He warned that an escalation in cyber attacks could lead to war. Biden also said Russia has nuclear weapons and oil wells and nothing else to earn money from. The U.S. president claimed this economic weakness makes Russia even more unpredictable and dangerous. The Russians were quick to respond. The Kremlin said Biden's statements showed America's erroneous understanding of modern Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow regrets that America is more of an adversary than a partner, despite the Russian government showing political will to normalize ties. Observers believe the latest exchanges further reveal the depth of distrust and deep differences between Washington and Moscow.
Russians have begun to reassert their normal geographic dominance in the area. And in particular, this was true with Ukraine. And, you know, so can you imagine the situation if the Russians had on the Canadian border, you know, an army? We would freak out. Well, the Russians feel the same way about NATO being in the middle of Europe now. And they felt very, very betrayed by the fact that NATO expanded, because they felt they had a deal in the 1980s with Gorbachev that that wouldn't happen. And so they're upset about that and have been very clear about that.
Problems that have soured bilateral relations are many. And both sides seem unwilling to back down when it comes to strategic issues. The upcoming talks will probably show whether the two sides are serious enough to resolve their problems.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that one key lesson for future administrations to learn from the experience gained during the tenure of outgoing President Hassan Rouhani is that there is no benefit in putting one's trust in the West. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with the members of President Rouhani's administration. He said it was manifested during the tenure of this administration that nothing can be gained from putting one's trust in the West. The leader added that domestic programs should in no way be tied to Western states under any circumstances due to the proven failure of such an approach.
Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's regional role have nothing to do with the original JCPOA or United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. They are simply irrelevant. And so to the extent that the United States continues to attempt to utilize maximum pressure to bring in irrelevant issues such as ballistic missiles and Iran's regional role, I believe that we will very soon reach this impasse and that the Raisi administration will bring an end to this charade in Vienna.
Making a reference to the ongoing talks in Vienna, Austria, to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Ayatollah Khamenei acknowledged that endeavors made by Iranian diplomats, saying, however, that Americans insisted on their hostile stance against Iran and did not move even one step forward during the talks. The leader denounced the U.S. attempts to add new terms to the agreement to push Iran to begin talks on other issues. He said by adding such a clause, the Americans are seeking to gain an excuse for further meddlesome acts regarding Iran's missile program and regional issues.
If the talks in Vienna aren't already at an impasse, I believe that this is where we're going to be heading very soon if the United States continues to refuse to return to its responsibilities and its obligations under the agreement and instead attempts to utilize the illegal terrorist sanctions and maximum pressure campaign of the Trump regime in Vienna to acquire leverage over Iran in the negotiations, specifically regarding issues that have nothing to do with the JCPOA.
Ayatollah Khamenei drew attention to the fact that the U.S. has refused to provide Iran with a guarantee that it will not violate its commitments again. He noted that Washington will not shy away from violating its contractual commitments in the same manner that it did in 2018, a move that was completely costless for them. 6 rounds of negotiations have been held so far in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the Iran nuclear deal, which has come to be known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. 3 years ago, the U.S., under former President Donald Trump, withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and branded what it called the Maximum Pressure Campaign against Iran. Now President Joe Biden, who was the Vice President of the United States when the deal was inked, has promised to re-enter the JCPOA and abandon Trump's failed Maximum Pressure Campaign.
Iran's position on the JCPOA and international law has been clear and consistent since the signing of the JCPOA in 2015. And so as such, I don't believe that an incoming Raisi administration or frankly any new incoming Iranian presidential administration would handle the current talks and negotiations any differently.
But so far, he's practically followed footsteps of his predecessor. President-elect Ibrahim Raisi will be officially sworn in on August 5th. Raisi won the June 18 presidential election in a landslide victory. garnering over 18 million votes. It's widely believed the foreign policy in Iran has a well-established and large-scale framework. When it comes to the issue of the Vienna talks, Iran's policies are not going to change. Therefore, no fundamental changes are expected in the negotiation process under the next administration. However, analysts believe the next administration needs to bolster the national position of Iran to successfully counter the bullying stance of the U.S. and its allies.
Tunisia is facing its worst crisis in a decade after President Kais Saied ousted the government of Prime Minister Hicham Mechichi and suspended parliament with help of the army. Saied has announced that he would assume executive authority with the assistance of a new prime minister. This is seen as the biggest challenge yet to Tunisia's democratic system. Kais Saied has also imposed a nighttime curfew across the country to prevent unrest and violence. Parliament Speaker Rachid Ghannouchi, who heads Ennahda party, has condemned Saied's decision as an assault on Tunisia's democracy.
Today we are surprised by supreme decisions that not only surprise Ennahda, but also surprise the Tunisian people and the world in a country that is proud of being the first Arab democracy and having the latest constitution.
Ennahda has played an important role in successive coalition governments. Ghannouchi has urged his supporters to take to the streets to show their anger at the president's decision. Tunisia has witnessed mass protests in several cities across the country against the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the dismal state of the economy.
Well, I guess Tunisia is going through turmoil and many problems. Internal problems and, of course, foreign problems because of the relationship between, for example, Ennahda and Saied with the French and with the Emirates and all these things.
The president has described his actions as constitutional and said Article 80 of the Constitution gave him power to dismiss the government, appoint a temporary administration, freeze parliament, and lift the immunity of its members.
Some have talked yesterday about a coup. I don't know in which law or political sciences school they studied. How can a coup be based on the Constitution? This is an implementation of the constitutional script. Article 80 of the Constitution gave the President of the Republic the right to take the procedures he sees necessary in the face of an imminent danger.
Tunisia witnessed a successful revolution back in 2011. Back then, Tunisians ousted the country's former Western-backed ruler, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, following mass protests. Many believe the revolution failed to deliver prosperity or good governance.
And I guess the issue is very, very deep and profound because there is a great conflict between these people in the government who have made a kind of collaboration between the secularists and the Ennahda movement. Ennahda movement through its relations with the Turks and Bin Said with the Emirates and the French and the NATO, there is a problem.
President Said is reported to have requested critical financial assistance from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt in order to stave off the crisis. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are seen as opponents of the Muslim Brotherhood. Ennahda, which is an important force in Tunisia's political landscape, is said to have close ties with the Muslim Brotherhood. In recent years, Ennahda has sought to distance itself from the Brotherhood. Regional allies of Ennahda, including Turkey and Qatar, have sharply criticized President Saied's moves.
What will do, what will make a probably a possible exit from this crisis is that to go all of them to a new constitution that would distribute the legitimacies and the privileges of the institutions, the constitutional institutions, into a new relationship that depends on the election, on the people, to go to a new referendum, about the situation in Tunisia. But I guess the situation in Tunisia is going to really deteriorate and accelerate more in a dangerous manner.
Opponents of President Saeed have likened him to Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who deposed the Brotherhood's elected former president, Mohamed Morsi, and banned the group in 2013.
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States this year. In a mid-year report, America's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization detailed several instances of incidents, including hate crimes, harassment, school bullying, discrimination, and hate speech. The council documented a spike in anti-Muslim incidents in May and June, including four at mosques in May alone. These cases include vandalism, harassment towards women who wear a hijab or headscarf, and an attempted stabbing. The spike coincided with Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip that ended in a May 21st ceasefire and killed at least 250 Palestinians.
Well, there are a number of reasons. One, I think Donald Trump brought white nationalism and discrimination and even racism against Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians into mainstream American political discourse. The other reason is, of course, that Israel launched an attack on Gaza in May of 2021. For 11 days, they bombed Gaza, and the militant groups in Gaza retaliated by firing rockets back into Israel.
The growing number of anti-Muslim hate incidents is drawing reactions from the U.S. Congress, too. Minnesota's Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar is leading a group of lawmakers calling on the U.S. President Joe Biden to nominate a special envoy to combat Islamophobia. The group has pointed to a rising number of individuals connected to larger white supremacist networks as perpetrators of Islamophobia. In a letter to U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar also referred to a June 6 car attack in Canada that killed four members of the same Muslim family.
Their lives were taken in a brutal, cowardly, and brazen act of violence. This killing was no accident. This was a terrorist attack motivated by hatred in the heart of one of our communities.
The National Council of Canadian Muslims urged Trudeau to address what it called the deep-seated systemic Islamophobia in the country, suggesting the appointment of a special envoy to confront the issue. Back in March, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres cited a UN report which found that suspicion, discrimination, and outright hatred towards Muslims has risen to, quote, epidemic proportions.
Anti-Muslim bigotry is sadly in line with other distressing trends we are seeing globally. A resurgence in ethno-nationalism, neo-Nazism, stigma and hate speech targeting vulnerable populations, including Muslims, Jews, some minority Christian communities, as well as others.
But this is a relatively new phenomenon. The anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim view has had, over 100 years of being part of the American psyche, and the pro-Israel forces, both the evangelical Christians and, of course, the Zionist Jews, have been very, very successful in getting their narrative accepted without question.
Limitations on Muslims sharing their beliefs, discrimination on receiving citizenship, and defaming Muslim communities were some manifestations of anti-Muslim biases the UN chief mentioned. Guterres added that Muslim women face triple levels of discrimination because of their gender, ethnicity, and faith, while the media and some persons in power have further compounded the stereotypes. The UN has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Activists say it's not enough to trust Biden's promises to end U.S. support for the war. Congress must compel him. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sarah Lazar Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Congress Needs to Force Biden to End Yemen War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Yemen is in a catastrophic state, says Kothar Abdullah, an organizer with the Yemeni Alliance Committee, adding, I have family there. Every day when I call and talk to them, the reality on the ground is far worse than it is ever portrayed. Abdullah, who is based in New York, is part of a network of grassroots organizers across the country calling on Congress to force an end to U.S. participation in the Saudi-led war using the same war powers resolution vetoed by former President Donald Trump in 2019. These organizers are asking lawmakers to go head-to-head with the Biden administration, which announced in February it was halting U.S. support for offensive operations, but nearly 6 months later has failed to fully extricate itself from the military intervention. As ongoing Saudi-led airstrikes collide with a worsening COVID-19 crisis, organizers like Abdullah are rallying in the streets and marching to lawmakers' offices, demanding they use their power to stop all U.S. participation in the violence, as well as the Saudi-led naval blockade that is chucking off fuel supplies, spiking food costs, and contributing to power outages at hospitals. Some activists have even gone on hunger strike to demand material relief from what is widely considered the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdullah says it's imperative that a war powers resolution is introduced and passed under a Biden administration. So many lives are at stake here. Organizers are up against an administration that has not been forthcoming about what's doing on the ground. The Biden administration's February announcement was met with much fanfare, but public details on what constituted offensive operations and what exactly an end to the U.S. role would look like were vague from the outset. The Biden administration has since avoided providing details about what American withdrawal looks like. There are signs that the United States of America remains enmeshed in that war. In June, Ilyas Youssef of the Center for International Policy published a briefing which found that the U.S. has stopped providing some forms of assistance, mid-air refueling of aircraft, intelligence and surveillance used to identify bomb targets and arms transfers for fixed-wing aircraft used to carry out bombings, but other forms of assistance continue. The U.S. continues to provide maintenance and sustainment assistance to the Royal Saudi Air Force, RSAF, notes Yusuf, a function that is essential to keeping Saudi aircraft flying. Meanwhile, the United States has not put a stop to other forms of transfers. This could include munitions used by attack helicopters, artillery, and armored vehicles, notes Yusuf. The United States is also providing ships and training to the Royal Saudi Naval Force, which is leading the blockade of Yemen, although the role of the United States is enforcing this blockade is unclear. On July 16th, a coordinated day of action saw protests in Boston, New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. calling for a new aggressive effort to end the war. Activists hand-delivered letters to members of Congress who are in positions of power or have historically led on efforts to end the war, among them Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Representative Gregory Meeks, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. These activists say that with Democrats in control of the House, Senate, and the White House, there is no reason this war should continue a moment longer. If Joe Biden and the U.S. Congress wanted to end this war, they could do it today, Paul Shannon, founder of the Raytheon Anti-War Campaign, said in a press statement. Since Biden made the announcement in February, some members of Congress have spoken out. Later the same month, 41 members of Congress called for transparency on U.S. involvement in the war. In April, 76 members of Congress released a letter calling on the Biden administration to demand an end to the blockade. And in May, 16 members of Congress signed another letter led by Senator Warren calling on the Biden administration to use all tools to end Saudi coalition's blockade of Yemen. But activists say they don't want members of Congress to merely ask. They want them to legislate like they did under President Trump. During Trump's tenure, members of Congress led multiple efforts to invoke the 1973 War Powers Act, passed in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, to force an end to the U.S. role in the Yemen war. The act says that Congress can compel a president to withdraw from a conflict if Congress has not formally declared or authorized the war, which the United States did not in Yemen's case. Shirin Al-Adaimi, a Yemeni-American organizer and a board member of advocacy organization Just Foreign Policy, tells In These Times that U.S. involvement in this war was illegal when it began under the Obama administration, illegal when it continued through Trump's presidency, and illegal now during the Biden's presidency. Democrats should not rely on Biden's promises to end this illegal and inhumane war, she argues. The leaders of the Trump-era War Powers Resolution, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Chris Murphy, and Representative Ro Khanna, have so far declined to take similar action under Biden, but there are indicators the leadership could come from elsewhere. On July 27th, call with the anti-war organization Code Pink, Representative Pramila Jayapal mentioned the possible threat of a Yemen War Powers Resolution in the context of a previous Congressional Progressive Caucus fight to structure the rules at the beginning of the new Congress. If the administration were not to do what we think is necessary to stop the blockade in Yemen, as an example, we would then be able to bring up a privileged War Powers Resolution for a vote, said Jayapal, who is the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The remarks followed a classified briefing earlier on July 27th, attended by several members of the CPCN, Senator Warren. Among them was Representative Ilhan Omar, who took to Twitter to speak out against the Saudi-led blockade. activists, some of whom are watching their family and loved ones back in Yemen suffer under harrowing conditions, want lawmakers to take action soon and aggressively. This means mastering the political will to confront a democratic administration. Abdullah argues that the suffering of Yemenis should not only be invoked when it's politically expedient. We can't just be tokenized depending on the political weather at the moment. Hassan Al-Tayeb, lead lobbyist on West Asia Region Policy for Friends Committee on National Legislation, told in these times that any measure to curb U.S. involvement in Yemen war is a step forward. Congress needs to step in and take legislative action. They have a number of tools they can use to cut off ongoing U.S. complicity, including in a must-pass NDAA appropriations bill and even a new war powers resolution, he said. They should consider all options when trying to end U.S. complicity. Numerous activists told in these times that of all the tools lawmakers could wield, a war powers resolution would be most impactful by far. The blockade, which seems to be contingent on continued U.S. support, is the biggest driver of the calamity in Yemen, which was the broadest humanitarian crisis prior to COVID, and which has, of course, been exacerbated by the pandemic. David Segal, executive director of the online advocacy organization Demand Progress, tells in these times, war powers resolution remain the most potent tool for forcing the administration to address this, he adds, because from a procedural vantage, the process of securing a vote floor vote is easier than with the other vehicles, and WPRs can't be filibustered in the Senate. Al-Ademi agrees and says that measures in the NDAA are not sufficient to protect Yemenis from U.S. attacks. If these measures go through, they will likely only last for 1 year. It's also arguably unethical to advocate for measures in an inflated war budget that should be drastically cut, not supported. The WPR, on the other hand, can be invoked any time by any member of Congress, brought to debate without delays, and once it's made into federal law, cannot easily be revoked by subsequent executive powers by this administration and beyond. Given Biden's public statements about ending U.S. support for the war, he will also not likely veto it should it pass through Congress. In the meantime, says Abdullah, the blockade is affecting every other aspect of life. There is a fuel shortage, no fuel for hospitals, lack of access to water. She adds, it's very, very important for a war powers resolution to be introduced and passed under the Biden administration, under a Democratic administration.
The British government has proposed reforms to the Official Secrets Act that could potentially see journalists and whistleblowers punished with much harsher sentencing for publishing things that the government doesn't like. Now, this comes as the United Kingdom has granted the United States limited permission to appeal a judge's decision in January not to extradite Julian Assange. A key witness for the U.S. prosecution recently admitted to fabricating their testimony against Assange. So why is the U.K. allowing the proceedings to go ahead anyway and clamping down on the rights of journalists? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The case against Julian Assange is not just an attack on journalism. It's a case that is filled with anomalies, illegalities, and government wrongdoing and foul play. Julian Assange's extradition hearing took place almost a year ago in September 2020 in London, dubbed the trial of the century. I was there as it unfolded, and we covered it extensively on this program. Now, in January earlier this year, the judge overseeing the case, Judge Barretza, decided not to extradite Julian Assange to the United States. The incoming Biden administration made it clear that it would be appealing this decision and moving forward with the Trump administration's plan to jail the Australian journalist and founder of WikiLeaks. Now, 6 months later, in July of 2021, a British High Court gave the United States permission to appeal that decision. The United States attempted to appeal on five grounds, however, only three were granted by the High Court. Now, the grounds of appeal deal almost exclusively with Julian Assange's health and the potential risk of suicide were he to be sent to the United States. During both pre-trial and post-trial, Assange would most certainly be placed in solitary confinement in a U.S. federal super maximum prison, such as ADX Florence in Colorado. Judge Barretza ruled that an extradition to the United States would pose such a significant risk to Assange's health that she blocked it on those grounds. However, she did agree with all of the other arguments put forward by the U.S. prosecution, namely the political charges such as espionage and conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. If convicted, Assange could face up to 175 years in prison. Such a ruling is dangerous because it effectively criminalizes journalism and national security reporting. It's saying that if you publish damning evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and diplomatic cables, you will be sent to jail for informing the public. Now, this means that an appeal in the U.K. High Court will only discuss Julian Assange's health and the prospects of his extradition and nothing else, because the judge has already accepted that his publishing, his work, his journalism amount to criminal behavior. Needless to say, this is a disaster for journalists everywhere and highlights just how problematic this entire case is. Now, the defense does have an opportunity to cross-appeal the decision, which would allow them to dispute the judge's agreement with the political charges. However, this is uncertain yet, as no announcement on that move has been made thus far. Now, just as the United States was granted this limited permission to appeal, it turns out the United States also made an offer to the UK that it could let Julian Assange potentially serve his sentence in his home country of Australia. The US also provided assurances that it would not place Julian Assange under special administrative measures, also known as SAMs. SAMs are a very strict regime where prisoners are kept in solitary confinement up to 23 hours a day. All of their incoming and outgoing mail is screened. They are only allowed one telephone call a month for 30 minutes, only to a pre-approved person. And this call, they must request this call in advance so that a government agent can be made available to spy on the conversation. The prisoners' conversations with their lawyers are also monitored. As a matter of fact, the lawyers themselves are placed under a gag order, preventing them from telling the outside world about their clients' conditions and what's happening inside of the jail. These horrific conditions are very likely what Assange would be placed under were he to be extradited to the United States. Everyone understands this, including the judge. Now, in court, the United States lawyers repeatedly argued that SAMs were not that bad, right? They made an attempt to portray these inhumane prison conditions in the United States as acceptable or humane. The prosecution even argued that there was an appeal process for prisoners to progressively lift these restrictions on themselves, even though not a single prisoner has ever succeeded in doing so. Now, Gary McKinnon, who's a Scottish systems administrator, he's said to have perpetrated the biggest computer hack of all time. In 2002, he accessed computers belonging to the U.S. Air Force, Navy, the Department of Defense, NASA, and much more. The U.S. also tried to extradite him to face jail time, but ultimately failed after a lengthy and grueling legal battle that lasted a decade. I spoke with Gary not too long ago, and I asked him about the so-called assurances that he was given by the United States at the time. And unsurprisingly, he told me that they're worthless, just like the ones that have been made to Assange now. Now, reacting to these so-called assurances, Assange's partner and fiancée Stella Morris said, quote, "They aren't worth the paper they're written on." She was quick to remind people that these assurances emanate from the same U.S. figures and organizations who spied on Assange and tried to steal their son's diaper from the Ecuadorian embassy for DNA analysis. Morris also lambasted the media for reporting inaccurately on these assurances, right, as if they were set in stone and 100% guaranteed, when in fact there is a very important distinction to be made. The United States did not say that it won't place Assange under SAMS. It said that it might not place Assange under SAMS, and that is not the same thing, right? In their so-called assurances, the U.S. explicitly says that it still reserves the right to place Julian Assange under special administrative measures if he does something that would warrant such a regime, whatever that might be. The U.S. also said that it won't place Assange in ADX Florence, which is the super maximum prison in Colorado. It didn't say it won't place him in any supermax. It just said ADX Florence, and that's a problem because ADX Florence is the only super maximum prison at the federal level, but the United States has many other super maximum prisons. And it did not say that it won't place Assange in any of its super maximum prisons. It only mentioned ADX Florence. Again, this is why no one can trust the United States and their reassurances, because they don't mean anything. The United States also said that Assange will be able to serve a sentence in Australia, but why should Assange serve any sentence, whether in the US or Australia or elsewhere? Assange is an innocent man. He's not been convicted of the crimes that they are accusing him of, and yet he still sits in Belmarsh prison in a maximum security jail. Why is that? Ultimately, the decision to place him under special administrative measures will be left up to the CIA director and the Attorney General. And given the intelligence community's animosity and contempt for Assange, and the fact that the DOJ is going after him so viciously from administration to administration, it's absolutely guaranteed that he will be placed under SAMS. There is no doubt about this, and the U.S. openly advocated this possibility in court, as I've seen myself. Now, these developments, they come at a strange time, however. Barely a week before the United States was granted limited permission to appeal, a bombshell revelation appeared in an Icelandic newspaper named Stundin. One of the key witnesses in the prosecution against Assange admitted that he had lied and fabricated his entire witness statement against the WikiLeaks founder. Sigurdur Thordarson, also known as Siggy the Hacker, is referred to in the U.S. indictment as Teenager. Now, this superseding indictment was unsealed in June 2020, just before the extradition hearing was set to proceed at the Old Bailey in London. The new indictment contained no new charges. Instead, it only had conduct, alleged conduct, which refers to narrative taken from testimonies like Siggy the Hacker's or from Sabu, who's another hacker turned FBI informant. This alleged conduct had only one purpose, which was to paint Assange as a hacker and a cyber criminal rather than a journalist. And although there were no new charges, this alleged conduct would be helpful for the prosecution in securing a conviction and or stronger sentencing. In his witness statement to the court, Thordarson exaggerated his relationship with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. He falsely claimed that Assange had instructed him to commit a number of crimes together, such as stealing encrypted banking files and recording the phone call conversations of members of parliament in Iceland, referred to in the indictment as NATO Country 1. Quote, Thordarson now admits to Sundin that Assange never asked him to hack or access phone recordings of MPs. His new claim is that he had in fact received some files from a third party who claimed to have recorded MPs and had offered to share them with Assange without having any idea what they actually contained. He claims he never checked the contents of the files or even if they contained audio recordings, as his third-party source suggested. He further admits the claim that Assange had instructed or asked him to access computers in order to find any such recordings is false. Now, during his time with WikiLeaks, Thordarson also worked to hurt the organization. He impersonated Julian Assange and embezzled $50,000 from online sales while committing various other crimes that were unbeknownst to Assange and WikiLeaks. Quote, Thordarson also admits that he stole documents from WikiLeaks staff by copying their hard drives. Among those were documents from Renata Avila, a lawyer who worked for the organization, and Mr. Assange. Now, Thordarson also went on to contact the U.S. Embassy in Iceland and volunteer to become an informant against Assange. Within 48 hours, a private jet full of U.S. government agents touched down in Iceland in order to begin working with him. It's incredible, absolutely incredible, then, that barely a week after this explosive revelation, the UK still decides to grant the US limited permission to appeal. I mean, the entire indictment is based on lies. And unfortunately, Judge Baretzer's ruling was formulated based on those lies. Usually, one would expect this case to be thrown out after such a bombshell revelation. And yet, that has not happened. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I'm joined by investigative journalist Stefania Morizzi. She contributes to a major Italian daily, Il Fatto Quotidiano, and has previously written extensively for some of the best newspapers in Italy, such as Espresso and Repubblica. She's renowned the world over for her amazing work as a media partner with WikiLeaks, and has also worked previously with Glenn Greenwald on the NSA leaks from Edward Snowden. She's a good friend, and it's my pleasure to welcome her. Thanks for coming on, Stefania. It's really great to have you.
Oh, thanks to you, Richard. Thanks so much.
So, Stefania, I'd like to start out with the fact that just recently Julian Assange turned 50 years old while he's locked up inside Belmarsh Prison in London. And you've known him a long time. You know, very tragically, he spent his entire 40s being persecuted by various governments for his journalism, hasn't he?
Well, first of all, I can remember that I was one of the journalists invited to his 40th birthday party, and I couldn't attend it. I couldn't be there because I was under pressure working on my book. And I mean, it was so sad. Now I realize how sad it is, because he has always been under confinement, under house arrest. His 40th birthday party was at Ellingham Hall. He was under house arrest. And then inside the embassy, 7 years, 6 years and 8 months without an hour outdoors. And then now in maximum security prison, the so-called British Guantanamo. And, you know, he has never known freedom again.
We recently had a bombshell revelation in the Icelandic newspaper in Stundin that one of the key witnesses who's testifying against Julian for the U.S. prosecution, Sigurdur Thordarson, who's also known as Siggy the Hacker, he fabricated his testimony. I mean, this is an incredible development. So you would think that the entire case would collapse based on this alone, never mind all the other cases of foul play that we've seen. Why is it, do you think, that this has gone largely unreported and unconsidered by the courts and the judiciary?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it will be a serious problem for the U.S. authorities. I mean, they are relying on a person who is highly problematic, to say the least, you know? Apparently, I mean, I have never met Siggy, though I have worked for 10 years, for over a decade on the WikiLeaks documentation and the case. I have never met Siggy. However, I have always heard that he was volunteering and with doing minor tasks. And it was highly problematic. And according to the many press reports, he had serious problems. He tried to steal money from WikiLeaks. He was an FBI informant, and even the Icelandic authorities were absolutely against collaborating with the FBI. This meant that they realized there was something really bad about this situation. I never heard, you know, it's quite unique that police national authorities refuse to cooperate with the FBI. Usually, you know, it is considered prestigious. It is kind of prestigious for police authorities to cooperate with the FBI. So if they refuse to cooperate, it even went public, This means that probably they smell something really bad. So I believe this case will be highly problematic for the U.S. So I expect some interesting development.
Yeah, I mean, it is astonishing, right? Because just barely a week after this bombshell revelation, the U.K. granted the U.S. limited permission to appeal Judge Bretzer's decision not to extradite. I mean, why do you think it is that the U.K. gave them limited permission? And it was just on three grounds, right? So 3 out of 5. Why is that?
As far as I can understand, the U.K. did not deny, grant permission to appeal to the U.S., but they did not grant the appeal on the basis of his health conditions. So it seems to me that they are trying to keep these health conditions as, kind of as the unique factor on which they rely to deny extradition, which is highly problematic, because they should deny extradition on the basis of his work, not just on his health conditions. This is the real scandal about this case. Had we had serious adversarial journalism, there would be a fuss, there would be a public scandal about this case. Even in the U.S., there is, apart from the independent media, apart from the independent reporters, and apart from Glenn Greenwald, there is basically no coverage. I believe that the public opinion understand very little about this case because there is no coverage, you know?
And, Stefani, speaking of the United States, they said allegedly that they won't put Julian under special administrative measures or SAMs, but they reserve the right to do so, and they're also supposedly offering him an opportunity to serve a sentence in Australia. I mean, why should he serve any sentence in the first place? What do you make of these so-called assurances from the U.S.?
This case is a travesty and a travesty of justice, and this case is a massive scandal, and these diplomatic assurances should never have been trusted, as Amnesty International immediately acknowledged. They are absolutely unreliable. They say, well, we will not put you in a maximum security prison in the most extreme U.S. prison, ABX Florence, but if you do something we don't like, we will reserve the right to do it. You know, how can you accept anything like that, you know? And he should never have to go to the U.S. No chance he goes to the U.S. and he comes out, he should never have to go there.
Truly, I mean, I wholeheartedly share your sentiment, Stefani. And just as a last question, I was wondering if you maybe heard about the recent developments regarding the Official Secrets Act in the UK. You know, the British government is now saying it wants to punish journalists who leak damaging information for up to 14 years. I don't know did you hear about that, perhaps? Because, you know, to me, it looks like they're just kind of trying to make sure they copy the United States and keep up with, you know, the same brand of authoritarianism.
Don't underestimate what they are doing. They have a serious strategy, a very serious strategy. And the confirmation comes from my Freedom of Information litigation on Christine Raftson, Joseph Farrell, and Sarah Harrison. They are using national security, and they are denying me this documentation about them. And this documentation is the correspondence between Scotland Yard, the so-called Metropolitan Police, Scotland Yard, and the U.S. Department of Justice. And they claim we cannot reveal this documentation because it would compromise the national security.